So we will want to have our Bibles open again to Psalm 18, page 454, if I remember correctly. I'm going to be opening my own personal copy of the scriptures up at this point. Psalm 18. As I said, the third longest psalm, at least by number of verses, after Psalm 119 and then Psalm 78. There are two parts to what I've got to say this morning. Initially, I'm simply going to outline Psalm 18, offer something of a roadmap, and for that reason, you probably want to have the scriptures open on your lap or on your mobile. And I'm going to make a few practical applications along the way. But then after that, we're going to zoom into just one remarkable thing. One remarkable thing about Psalm 18. Now, there are many remarkable things about Psalm 18. All right. We're just going to look at one. All right. First of all, an outline of the psalm. And this is a sweeping outline. I've already told you that the title is long. It's the longest one in the whole of the Psalter. Apart from identifying the author, David, King David, real man, the title also strongly hints, and that's an understatement, the title also strongly hints at least one time when David sang this song. Look at the words of the title. To the choir master, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of the song to the Lord on the day. On the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Those words strongly suggest a point in time just before, or perhaps on the very day that David was crowned king. In other words, Psalm 18 is a psalm of heartfelt thanksgiving to the Lord after the Lord had removed every human impediment to David becoming king. Now, as an aside, Psalm 18 also appears almost verbatim in 1 Samuel chapter 22. Or rather 2 Samuel 22. So, if you want to just quickly, those who've got Bibles, you might want to turn back rather, not forward, to 2 Samuel 22. And if you scan your eyes down chapter 22, you're going to see the form of a psalm. And what you're going to see, if you looked at it in detail, is effectively Psalm 18. Almost verbatim. There are differences at points, but almost verbatim. Some people have speculated that possibly the Psalm 18 that we have in the Psalter is a slightly edited later version. All right? The Psalter was put together finally after the exile, when the people were back in Jerusalem. Psalm 18 is, some speculate, a slightly edited version of what was originally penned and recorded recorded in 2 Samuel 22. But let that be. Just look at chapter 23, all right? You're going to find that chapter 22 immediately comes before the last words of David. Chapter 23 starts with these words. Now, these are the last words of David, chapter 23. Chapter 22 has Psalm 18 in it, all right? That has led some Bible experts to conclude wrongly, given the title that David himself gives his own psalm, they have concluded that Psalm 18 was written towards the end of David's life. Yet, and this is what I want you to notice, yet, exactly the same introduction or title appears in 2 Samuel chapter 22 as is found at the top of Psalm 18. Reading from 2 Samuel 22. All right. And David spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And then it goes on to say, verse 2, he said, right, on the day. And then what follows it? They eliminate the end of David's life as an option, at least in all probability. And the timing, and the reason I'm touching on this is not hair splitting. The timing is significant. You will see. The timing is significant. In fact, it's what the remarkable thing stands on, right? Okay. The timing is not as insignificant as you might think. For the moment, now here I've got to get myself out of a tangle, because why would you have chapter 22 with Psalm 18 immediately before chapter 23, the last words of David? All right, I've got to get myself out of a bit of a tangle, along with a whole lot of other Bible commentators, etc., and I'm not an expert, I rely on them. But for the moment, and as I see things, 2 Samuel chapter 22 and 23 simply represent two compositions. They simply represent two compositions bracketing David's reign, David's time as king. All right? In other words, here's the beginning, chapter 22, and here's the end of David's rule, chapter 23. Anybody listen to Desert Island Discs? All right, at the end, they're allowed to take certain things to the island and choose their best song. And it could very likely be the first song they ever chose, all right, at the very end of the program. So chapter 22, one bracketing composition. Chapter 23, the final bracketing composition of David, his reign as king. All right. If there's anything worth emphasizing, it's this. And this is about the whole psalm. And I will give you this, what I call sweeping outline. David speaks in Psalm 18 as the king of Israel. Or almost the king of Israel. He's anointed. He's awaiting crowning. All right. Now, there are applications for every man and every woman. But first and foremost, Psalm 18 is not about us. It has applications. There are wonderful applications to us. But Psalm 18 is about the king. It's about God's king. And prophetically and ultimately, it's about Christ the king. There's no doubt that Psalm 18 is a messianic psalm. There's no doubt. As you walk through it, yes, you're going, this is David. And then there are other points where, oh, is this David or Christ? And then there are places where it just cannot be David. It has to be Christ. I just look at verse 50. Look at verse 50. And scan your eyes over the verses that precede it, 46 to 49. All right. Great salvation. He, that's the Lord, he brings to his king. And shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. At the very least, verse 50 ties the entire Davidic line together in one bundle. But who is the greatest descendant of David? Well, of course, it's Christ. There's no one in the line of David, including David himself, who enjoys the promises of verses 46 to 49 to the degree that Christ enjoys those promises, which is an inheritance, a booty from every nation on the face of the earth. Us. And here's a little question for you to meditate over and think and talk about afterwards. Did Christ sing this psalm after he had triumphed over the devil and death on the cross? I bet you he did. Now the psalm itself. As one reads through the psalm, there are five distinct sections. And I'm going to list them first for pure clarity's sake, and then just briefly touch on the content of each section and in unequal degrees, all right, before we get to the most remarkable thing. First of all, this is maybe take home just to help you as you digest the psalm, and you're welcome to differ with me. All right, verses 1 to 3, what we have in them are unabashed adoration. Unabashed adoration. In verses 4 to 6, we have life-threatening crisis. Life-threatening crisis. Verses 7 to 30, huge chunk. We have extraordinary rescue. Extraordinary rescue. And then verses 31 to 45, we have decisive victory. Decisive victory. And then finally in verses 46 to 50, we have unashamed acknowledgement. Unashamed acknowledgement. So what we've got in order is unabashed adoration, life-threatening crisis, extraordinary rescue, decisive victory, and unashamed acknowledgement. And my wording of the first and the fifth is deliberate. Unabashed adoration and unashamed acknowledgement are their own brackets, as it were, around Psalm 18. They're bookends. Verses 1 to 3 and verses 46 to 50 are bookends. And within them we have, and if there's a title for this sermon, within them we have the king's crisis, the king's rescue, and the king's victory. The king's crisis, the king's rescue, and the king's victory. But let's just work through those five sections. First of all, unabashed adoration, verses 1 to 3. What can we say about this section? Well, first of all, just look at it, scan down. I know it was a long psalm, and we've had prayer and a hymn in between, right? But I want you to notice three things. First of all, it's personal. It's personal. There are no less than four I's and 10 my's. Four I's and 10 my's in the space of just three verses. In other words, one in every four words is personal. Secondly, it's passionate. It's passionate. David gets straight to the point. No dilly-dallying, no mumbling words, no hesitation, no stammering. He says, I love you, O Lord. That's not simply the love of commitment and loyalty, as important as commitment and loyalty are. All right. This is the love of passionate attraction and attachment. Passionate attraction and attachment. Very strong, very expressive. And as the psalm unrolls, we should have seen, okay, as the psalm unrolls, as it were, we find that passion, that passionate attraction and attachment is not mindlessly stirred up in a vacuum. It stands on very solid ground. It's the overflow of truly experiencing and appreciating God's rescuing and redeeming grace and His love and faithfulness in what are very trying and desperate circumstances. In fact, trying and desperate circumstances that contradict the Lord's promises to David, his king. We'll get back to this. Although, let's think of Christ quickly. How many times did Christ's own trying and desperate circumstances appear to contradict his very mission as the promised Messiah? Indeed, the Father's promises to him, the Son, who's taken on the role as the Messiah. How many times did circumstances contradict heavenly commitments? Anyway, we've seen that it's personal, it's passionate. Personal, passionate. In the third place, it is particular. It is particular. Because love isn't satisfied with generalities. Love looks and love sees. Passion looks for and sees and adores things the disinterested don't bother to look for, let alone see. Passion perceives distinctions others don't perceive. You see the chaps on the railway platforms with their little books. They notice numbers we've never noticed before on the fronts and backs of rolling stock, don't they? All right, passion. Passion perceives distinctions others don't even notice. And then passion can't remain silent. Passion verbalizes what it adores with a level of definition and also detail that's initially bewildering to the spectator, the onlooker. But once just lingered over, starts to make sense. And I want you to notice the string of descriptors. I won't read them out again. The string of descriptors, the list of descriptors that David assembles or marshals, right, in service of his passion. They're very particular. David credits the Lord with being his support, his stability, his security, his safety, and his savior. And there's one word that ties all of those descriptors up, and it's the word salvation. The Lord is his salvation. The Lord is literally everything we vulnerable and needy souls need. Even souls in high places, kings. Life-threatening crisis, verses 4 to 6. Life-threatening crisis. There are two words that capture the focus and burden of this section, verses 4 to 6. And they are the words peril and prayer. Peril and prayer. First of all, peril. David's situation is literally life-threatening. It's a situation of frightening, stomach-tightening attack, vulnerability. David, using the language he uses, he is literally drowning in the water and the weed, tangled in the weed of crisis. What does David do? What can David do? Well, he prays. And that's the second word that sums up this section, verses 4 to 6. David prays. In other words, prayer. Right? David did what we should all do when we are distressed. We should pray. And I know we hear that again and again and again, but it's because we need to hear it again and again and again. Trial does its first and its best work. Trial does its first and its best work when it sends us to the Father. Listen to Alec Mateer. If we could have gone to David while he was under the enormous pressures described in verses 4 to 6 and asked him, "What are you doing about it?" he would have replied, "Oh, I'm praying." That's all. Mateer continues, "It was prayer that made the difference. Look at the second half of verse 6. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears." And that introduces the third section, verses 7 to 30. And here I'm going to be really brief because we're coming back to this, at least a large part of it. Thirdly, extraordinary rescue, verses 7 to 30. Extraordinary rescue. And there are two parts to this section. Verses 7 to 19 could be called action with an exclamation mark at the end. Action. The Lord moves in and he effects a rescue, and it is dramatic. We'll come back to this. But then in verses 20 to 30, we have analysis. David moves from describing the action into analysis. And what he does is he analyzes it two ways. First of all, he analyzes it personally, verses 20 to 24, right? Personally, he analyzes it and applies it to himself. And then verses 25 to 30, he applies it to people generally. So we've got action and then analysis. Now the fourth section, decisive victory. Decisive victory. This is separate to the extraordinary rescue. This follows the rescue. It enables the victory. All right? Verses 31 to 45. David's rescue is extraordinary, but it's not the end of the story. Christ, my God, why have you forsaken me? I'm cautious. I want to be deeply respectful here. But Christ's rescue, as it were, coming through the cross. Right? Everything against it. Now, he's different to David. But upheld in a mysterious way. He sees through his mission and he comes through. And what does he do? Put his feet up. He's vanquished death and the devil. What does he do? Put his feet up? No. Rescue always is followed or is always followed by enlistment or conscription. Conscription. When God delivered David from his distress and disaster, it wasn't for him to put his feet up. For David, enlistment involved championing God's cause and then leading God's people into battle. Literal battle. Christ is seated, but he is not inactive. There's a kingdom to secure and seal forever. Now, the graphic language of verses 31 to 45 can surprise us. It shouldn't surprise us because faith, living the life of faith, the situation of God's people, the community of faith on the face of the earth is a life and a death matter. Lives are given. And sometimes they are actually lost. You follow what I'm trying to distinguish between, all right? In the cause of Christ. And brothers and sisters and anybody else who's here, the final battle, the final victory of Christ the King will be more bloody, more awful, more decisive than any battle that David fought. Finally, the last section. The last section, unashamed acknowledgement, verses 46 to 50. 46 to 50. Irrespective of the part that David played at points and then only with God's help and enabling. All right. The rescue and the victory are all God's doing. And he acknowledges the Lord in verses 46 to 50. And I'm just going to quote two verses from the New Testament. We needn't turn there. You're familiar with them. Just to sum up the spirit, the thread of this final section of the psalm. You shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. And then also Romans 8 verse 37. We are more than conquerors. We are more than conquerors through him who loved us. It's all God. It's all God. It's all God. All right? Now there's the psalm in outline. Now for the one remarkable thing. The one remarkable thing. I'm going to entitle it this. The Theater of War. The theater of war. What is the theater of war? The theater of war is the arena within which a war plays out. You with me? If you're not familiar with the term, the theater of war is the arena, the area within which a war plays out. Look again at verses 7 to 15. In fact, let's read them again. Verses 7 to 15. Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations also of the mountains trembled and quaked because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him, thick clouds dark with water. out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through his clouds. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire, and he sent out his arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightnings and routed them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. Now, this is the Lord's answer to David praying. This is the extraordinary rescue. Now, is this just dramatic poetry, hyperbolic language, right? You know, the eternity of God is mind-blowing. You with me? Is it just dramatic poetry, hyperbolic language? It's too deliberate. It is too sustained to be simple poetic hyperbole. What Psalm 18 verses 7 to 15 show us is this. They show us that the theater of the war of wars, the war to end all wars, is much, much bigger than we are accustomed to assume, to think. Let me explain myself. Verses 7 to 15 describe the sights and sounds of an irresistible superpower rolling in. You can hear the rattly roll of dozens upon dozens of tanks and troop carriers. Can you hear them? The ground shaking and that air vibrating boom of superior firepower on the ground and also from the air. It's done in the language of a storm. All right? The picture that's painted before our eyes, our mind's eye, is of a fierce storm. There's lightning, there's thunder, there are hailstones, there's flash flooding at supernatural levels. This is not a normal storm. It reminds me of Desert Storm. Those who were around and conscious in 1991, do you remember Desert Storm in 1991? The first Gulf War, the liberation of Kuwait, and then the invasion of Iraq. It was the first war, do you remember, those who remember, to be live streamed to televisions. Right. Smoke, thunder, devastation. But we have a problem. There's a problem. At least superficially. David's rise to the throne wasn't like this. We have a problem. At least superficially. Now, we don't have time. All I can do is just capture and sum up what we find in the historical narrative. The historical narrative. That's between 1 Samuel 14, when David is anointed, and then 2 Samuel chapter 5. We look at that historical narrative and we find quite a different description. Things are described quite differently. There's little or no lightning, little or no thunder, little or no hailstones, let alone flash flooding, in David's journey to the throne. Yes, things start off quite spectacularly, don't they, with the slaying of Goliath. But after that, it's not long before things degenerate into a convoluted sequence of, yes, miraculous escapes, but they buy the skin of David's teeth, as it were, miraculous escapes, and then, sadly, disastrous compromises. You read 1 Samuel 14 through to 2 Samuel 5, and it's embarrassing reading at points. Yes, David's refusal to take history into his own hands by refusing to kill Saul on those two occasions that he could have killed him. That, we stand back in admiration. What a young man. But for the most part, David is literally on the run. he ends up seeking refuge with Israel's arch enemies at the time, the Philistines. He pretends, that passage where he pretends insanity before the king of the Philistines. And then after that, we find him acting duplicitously, in connection with the town of Ziklag. And in fact, things hit rock bottom in that town called Ziklag. Here's the point. Here's my point. David's ascent to the throne does not fit. At least it doesn't appear to fit the language of verses 7 to 15. So, if we have a problem, the next question is, what's going on? What's going on? Is David on drugs? Has he eaten the wrong mushrooms? 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 15 to 17. Now, those of you who don't know Old Testament history, just ask somebody who does afterwards for the broader context. But just listen to these words. Right. When the servant of the man of God, that's the man of God is Elisha, rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army, the Assyrian army, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" He, that's Elisha, said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. What's going on in Psalm 18? More particularly verses 7 to 15. What's going on in Psalm 18? This is what's going on in Psalm 18. David is describing the theater of war in its totality. He is seeing the unseen element, if he's seeing anything. His description is dominated by the unseen realm. "We wage war," says Paul, "not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." He says that in Ephesians 6. It doesn't seem that way, does it? But that's the reality. What's happening around us now? The unrolling of history isn't just what we see and experience. It involves activity and developments beyond the seen and experienced world. And I don't want to sort of point away, because it's here as well as there. We're dealing, literally speaking, with activity and developments that are out of this world. The issue is this. David's route to the throne involved things that the historical narrative doesn't acknowledge, but it doesn't deny. They're just not acknowledged, except in portions of Scripture like Psalm 18. Yes, the things that we see described in Psalm 18 are felt within the world we live and operate in. We do feel them, but we don't sense them in the sense that we sense the real, sensible, tangible, seen, concrete. But the things that happen in the unseen realm are still things which ultimately and primarily determine the end of the battle. As well as its nature and its direction now. Think of Job. Think of Job. Job's trials, as he experienced them, they were quite natural, weren't they? They were a cocktail, we could call it. A cocktail of very natural and scientifically verifiable events and developments. Weather. An infection in the skin or whatever it was. You with me? But behind them was something much, much bigger. Something that Job didn't see because he was part of the picture. He couldn't see the frame, could he? He couldn't see the frame. The characters in the pictures in the art museums, etc., they can't see the nice, lovely frames around them. They're in the picture. Job saw things and could have concluded, or felt things and could have concluded, without faith, that everything was natural and scientifically verifiable and explainable. Is it? Was it? No. Behind Job's trials was something much bigger, and it was a heavenly battle. It was a battle for his soul and his faith, and above that, the glory of God. But bless God, bless the Lord, it was nothing that the Lord didn't have complete control over. There was someone holding the reins. And bless God, there is someone holding the reins now. Right? Whose death we will remember shortly. The issue is this. Psalm 18 alerts us in very graphic terms to a world beyond our senses, which is as important, if not more important, than the world we predominantly or only sense. Do you remember the storming of the Iranian embassy? I'm going back further now, 1980. That was also televised, right? Quite a different thing to see it from outside as those crack troops slickly and audaciously stormed that embassy and delivered, rescued hostages. What was it like for the hostages? Quite a different experience until they were out. Here's the challenge, and we're on that last 50 meters now. The last 50 meters. Here's the challenge, brothers and sisters, and anybody who hasn't yet embraced Jesus Christ in saving faith. Here is the challenge. Are you budgeting for the unseen in life? Do you factor it into your understanding of both the wonderful successes that you experience in life as well as the skin of one's teeth escapes that you experience? Perhaps escapes you're not even aware of. Our little children, when we pluck them from danger with that lorry and they just cry, you know, heads in our arms, screaming that their little wills have been obstructed, when we've actually delivered them from severe fatal danger. How much is that happening to us on a daily, weekly, yearly basis? When the Father plucks us out of danger. Skin of the teeth escapes. Wonderful successes. Are we budgeting really and truly for the unseen? If we're not, we're practically deists. Deists. God is distant, remote, and just let the world tick over. Now, we're not to be obsessed with the unseen realm, are we? We're not to be obsessed with the unseen realm. Scripture makes that very clear. But equally, we need to be aware of the unseen realm. Scripture again makes that very clear too. And it does it both in terms of what it says about the unseen realm, and how it says it. And here I'm just going to tie a number of things very quickly together about the Bible's witness to the battle that we are in. The Bible's witness to the battle we are in. That witness is threefold. Threefold. The overwhelming majority of the witness to the battle we are in is what could be described as fog of war witness. Fog of war fitness witness. What does that mean? Dust. Noise. Crossfire. Sniper fire from who knows where it's coming from. Confusion. It's very easy to look back at wars and see how they were lost. It's not so easy to see how to win them. Fog of war. That's the first line of witness. The second line of witness is what I call the 30,000 foot drone view. A drone flying at 30,000 feet looking down. That's where battle lines are seen very clearly often, but it's quite surreal. It's like looking out of that aircraft window at the little cars moving up and down roadways, doesn't it? It doesn't look real. It's surreal. And that witness is found in, say, Ephesians 6, which I read. Paul's words, we wage war, not against, okay? That's the 30,000 foot drone view. 1 Peter 5 also addresses it. Peter, in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, he says, "See, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." Ever seen the roaring lion? Sometimes we sense his low grass, don't we? There's the 30,000 foot view. But then finally, there's a third line of witness, and we've touched on it this morning. The third line of witness is what I call dispatches from the front. That's the reports carried back by messengers. Material like we have in Psalm 18, Job chapters 1 and 2, 2 Kings chapter 6, also Daniel 10 when he encounters the Lord himself in the form of an angel. Spooky stuff. All right? Fog of war, 30,000 foot drone view, and then the dispatches from the front. We're not to be obsessed by the unseen realm, but we quite obviously need to be aware of it. And factoring it into our thinking will make us a lot more cautious as we interpret the apparently disastrous. What matters most is the Lord's presence and ultimately the Lord's victory, isn't it? As David shows us, the Lord was weaving rescue and deliverance out of the threads of disaster. And I find that immensely comforting and also exciting. Just think of the King, Jesus Christ. Who would ever have thought that the giving over of Christ to his enemies secured the greatest victory of all? A victory for which Christ is crowned and seated at the right hand of the Father, ruling over all things. That is a convoluted road to the crown. You see, David's story is also Christ's story in essence. Or rather, David's story is just a faint little echo, a finite little echo of the greatest story of all. And that story is only seen for what it is when the theater of war is seen and embraced by faith in its totality.